Hello, hey Boomer listeners. I hope you are having a good Monday. Today, we are going to be talking about the flu, COVID-19, and going into the fall. So since January, COVID-19 started as a disease in an isolated region of China, and it then evolved into this global pandemic that has caused countries to come to a standstill. It has created nightmares in hospital systems, and it has caused the global economy to go into a recession. Cases continue to spike and go down, and in Europe and the Middle East, they are now seeing some spikes that have caused some countries to close down again. When the universities opened, there were spikes in some of the student population. The University of Alabama and the University of South Carolina each reported up to 2,000 positive tests of students when schools opened. If you remember when all of this started, at first we thought, well, maybe it spread through contact surfaces. And so we would bring home our groceries and sanitize everything before we put it away. And then we would sanitize the countertops after that. And then we were told, well, transmission is less likely by surface contact. It's more likely through aerosol transmission, person to person. And so the guidance became wear your mask, socially distance, 6 feet apart. Outdoors was supposed to be safer than indoor visiting. And lots of changing guidance from the CDC. So a lot of confusion, a lot of questions. What's the right thing to do today and going forward into the fall? So lots of questions for our guest today, Dr. Marcus Blackstone from Bonsa Cores. And I feel confident that he's going to be able to answer a lot of our questions with very practical, pragmatic recommendations. But before we go there, I wanted to, first of all, talk to you a little bit about the Hey Boomer community. All of you that are here today are part of the Hey Boomer community. And I love seeing you and seeing that you're saying hello. So hi, I can't say hi to each of you individually. I've been working really hard to get interesting, inspiring, and informative guests, and it's my privilege to start off the conversation with them. But as a community, everybody is involved in the conversation. And so I want you to post your questions in the chat, and I will share those questions with Dr. Blackstone. Anything that we are not able to get to today, I will compile your questions and share them with him. And then once I get his answers back, I will share them back out with the community. So please ask your questions, because we all have lots of confusion about what's the right thing to do. I also wanted to remind you that starting October 8th, I'm kicking off our 3-week community gathering around exploring happiness. This is going to be a time for the community to come together and share ideas, share support, help us all feel connected and feel a better sense of grounding and a better sense of well-being in spite of all of the things that are happening around us. I have 3 specific topics that I want to cover, and I will be sharing those out with you once you register. So if you want more information about that, please go ahead and send me an email. You can email me at heyboomer0413@gmail.com. Okay, so let me tell you a little bit about Dr. Blackstone, and I'm going to bring him on. Hello, Dr. Blackstone.
Hello, happy Monday.
Thank you. Happy Monday to you. So Dr. Blackstone is the Chief Clinical Officer at Bonsa Cores St. Francis Health System. He's going to help clear up some of the questions that we have today. He has been with the Bonsa Cores Medical Group since 2014, serving initially as the senior group lead physician for primary care, and then advancing to the role of physician lead for clinical quality, managed care contracts, and care model innovation. In this position, he combined his clinical expertise, strategic vision, entrepreneurial skills, and relationship building to address complex issues across multiple disciplines and service lines. He assumed the position of Chief Clinical Officer in April 2019, and he oversees the clinical functions for the hospitals and the Bon's Cours Medical Group. So Dr. Blackstone, again, thank you for being with us. I kind of set the stage for where we've come from to where we are today. Is there anything that you want to add before we get started with some of the questions that we all have?
Sure. I'll just do a quick recap. You know, we started back in March. And, you know, at that time, everybody was trying to figure out, you know, what was going on with the pandemic. We saw what started, as you said, in other parts of the world. You know, we had the opportunity to have some lessons learned, but to be frank, this was one of those on-the-job training because things were changing at such a rapid pace. You know, the scientists that we rely on for information were learning. Clinically, we were learning. And the big thing was to figure out how to take care of patients, but at the same time, keep them separated from non-COVID patients, but also protect our frontline employees. So it's been quite the ride. We're definitely not done. We won't be for quite some time, we think, but we're at least in a better place than we were, say, June and July. As you and I have talked previously, you know, we had an initial surge March through end of April, and then we kind of slowed down a little bit. But then about 2.5 weeks after Labor Day or Memorial Day, we saw a huge surge. It doubled our initial surge. To the point that, you know, it really pushed a lot of us to our limits from a bed capacity, you know, and staffing. And the interesting thing between the two was initially it was just, you know, patients who were developing COVID from their standpoint, you know, everything shut down. So people were at home. In the second surge, we got hit with the community piece. So not only do we have patients coming through the doors through our ER direct transfers from other hospitals, but now we have the community piece of our employees, you know, getting COVID in the community and then not being able to work. So it put all the hospitals in the upstate and, you know, in a tough situation to be able to staff beds. Even though we had plenty of beds and we have plans to increase beds and we've done that, it was how do you staff those beds? Mm-hmm. And because everybody was in the same spot, the travel nurses that we usually, you know, use, which is basically like a locums company, there were none to be found. A lot of them were actually in New York. They were in New Orleans. They were different places. And then when those states started calming down, a lot of the frontline employees and a lot of the locums and travel nurses, they were just worn out. So mm-hmm. It became a staffing issue for us. All of us managed through it. We never had to turn anybody away patient-wise. You know, our teams did a great job of juggling beds. So at the end of the day, we're in a better place, and there's a lot of lessons learned, you know, from our standpoint as we head into this fall.
Yeah, some of those lessons could be very interesting for us to talk about. But I wanted to first start with some of the questions that, you know, pertain to those of us who are civilians outside of the hospital.
Sure.
So let's start with testing, right? So we've seen the pictures on TV with these long lines at testing centers. And then we've heard reports that some people take a test, it takes 14 days to get the results back. You know, so how's that good? Because if you're supposed to be quarantining. So what's your advice about when to get a test, where to get a test? You know, what's the status of testing these days?
So first of all, we're in a much better place from a testing standpoint than we were. There's a lot more capacity. There's faster turnaround times. You know, we've been away from the 14-day turnaround time for a while. You know, most of the testing now, we actually have some, you know, in-house testing that we get in 24 to 36 hours. Most of the community testing is usually 3 days or less. Sometimes it's four, depending on the lab and what their capacity is. So it's a lot better than it, you know, than it was before. So really we look at, you know, really kind of 4 days or less to get results back at this point. And I actually checked again this morning before we did this, just to kind of see where we were, and it's still remaining 3 to 4 days. Sometimes it's 2 days to get it back, you know, when the test, when the community testing's done.
So do you need a doctor's referral to get a test?
No. So, you know, from a hospital testing standpoint, or if you use one of our drive-throughs, you know, like, you know, in our health system, you actually do need, you do need a test, because that's actually what we use those, that we use those strictly for patient testing and employee testing. But, you know, we've got the 8 AFC urgent cares. So they actually have walk-in testing. So actually we have, you know, we have two clinics that are set up for symptomatic patients. That's on Augusta Road and Pelham Road. And then we have Cherrydale location and Woodruff Road location, where if people just want to get tested, that they can just, they can go in and get tested. They don't have to have, you know, they don't have to have an order to get tested. There are also a couple of private labs here in Greenville that you make, you can make an appointment and get tested as well. So you don't always have to have a physician order. I don't know what Prisma is doing now. At one point they were requiring a, you know, a physician order to be able to get their testing done, and we're doing a virtual visit, but I know that they were thinking about backing off of that. So at this point, I'm actually not sure what they're doing from a testing standpoint.
So do you test your employees on a regular basis, or do you test them just because they have a symptom or they've been exposed? What's the protocol?
So interestingly enough, we started with a testing protocol and a testing strategy, which was what the CDC recommended. So if employees had any symptoms, they got tested, and we had an algorithm of how long they would be out until we got the test back. And then in the middle of July, CDC changed it from a testing strategy to a symptom strategy. So we went to a symptom strategy basically because we had so many employees out, and across the country, everybody did, because either waiting 7 or 14 days when we were having trouble getting test results back. So now we only treat employees if they're truly symptomatic from our standpoint, but if they are symptomatic, we still quarantine them like we've done previously.
Do you, is there a cost to the test if we go to the urgent care facilities?
There is not a cost. You know, we don't charge for any COVID-19 related. Now I think there are some plans that have copays, so they will take just the copay if it applies.
Okay. So the CDC guidance was that only people with symptoms should get tested. And then they changed it to say that anyone with close contact with a person that tested positive should get tested. What do you recommend?
So, you know, we agree. So if you're, if you have close contact with somebody who turns positive or tests positive, and you've been around that person within 6 feet for more than 15 minutes at a time, you know, especially if you haven't had mask on the whole time, then we recommend people get tested, because, you know, it's that asymptomatic person that doesn't feel bad, never has any symptoms, that we know, you know, will have a tendency to get around other people because they just feel fine. And so in that scenario, we do recommend testing.
Okay. So you brought up masks, and there's been lots of discussion and controversy around masks. I know the masks that y'all wear in the hospital protect you as well as your patients that you're in contact with. The masks that we wear out in public, do they protect us?
Sure they do. So, yeah. So, you know, a lot of people know I've been a mask and advocate from the beginning, even when people thought I was nuts for saying everybody needs to wear a mask. But I mean, historically, think about it. In medicine, you know, we wear a mask in an OR and have forever, because we know that, you know, the spread of germs through aerosol droplets has always been there. So, I mean, that's part of, you know, keeping a sterile field and keeping our germs out of the field, and wearing a mask is part of it. So, you know, in the hospital, there's three different types of masks. There's what's called a N95 mask, which really is a, it's almost like a ventilator type mask. It has a significant filter in it that really truly filters the air you know, back and forth. That's the one we use on the front lines in the hospital. That's the one we use for procedures. The rest of the areas of the hospital, we use a regular procedural mask or surgical mask, which is a soft, sometimes they tie back. Now they have the ear loops because we know that's adequate. You're really just trying to stop the spread of droplets, whether it's from sneezing, whether it's from coughing, you know, or somebody talking a lot or singing or something like that. You know, people don't realize that to do that, you have to move significant volume of air in and out. So the mask actually helps protect, you know, it protects us from, you know, infecting other people, you know, but at the same time, you do get the protection of the masks from if somebody is around you and they do that, the mask keeps the droplets off of you as well. Okay. And so that's the idea behind the mask, and whether it's the surgical mask N95 or a cloth mask. Now, what people don't realize, a cloth mask, those probably actually need to be washed more often than probably people do, but they do work. And, you know, if you look at the science behind it, it leads kind of into another area of the 6 feet that's picked for social distancing. There's actually science behind that. It's not just a made up number. You know, when you look at the slow motion videos of somebody coughing or sneezing, you know, it doesn't go 6 feet. You know, it may go 4 feet for most people, but that's the idea behind the 6 feet is to keep you out of basically the spray area, for lack of a better word. But we also know that if two people have a mask on, you know, the incidence of spread of COVID-19 is less than 2%. And so you really do get the protection, and depending on the type of mask people have on, it may be even less than that, you know, from that standpoint. Okay. And so, yeah, so, you know, so we're big proponents of masking.
Okay. So that's good to know. Now you mentioned the 6 feet, and then there was some recent news that said, well, maybe 6 feet isn't enough. Is 6 feet enough?
Yeah, 6 feet's enough.
Okay.
You know, everybody has their own theory. But when you look at the science, 6 feet's enough.
Okay. So if I'm out walking with a friend, now we're talking the outdoors, right? If I go for a walk with a friend, do we both need to wear masks if we're outside?
Well, here's the thing. So number one, making sure that you know where that person's been and have they been taking precautions. And number two, if you stay, you know, 6 feet apart and you're outside, you know, you can get away without wearing a mask at that point. But outside, you know, you got to be careful because outside in that situation or you're walking and you pass somebody is a little different than being outside in a crowd.
Mm-hmm.
So we know in the data that we look at that if you're in a crowd of 25 or more people in South Carolina, you know, at our highest rate, there's a 99% chance one person had COVID-19.
In 25 people.
So that's why we've always pushed, you know, from our standpoint, groups of 10 or less, and to know the groups you're in. You know, if you're especially if people are in a group and they don't know everybody in the group, and this is where you get into social settings, you know, where people tend to congregate. That's where we saw a lot of spread when we did the contact tracing was back to these groups when people didn't have a mask on.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why you'll hear us talk about groups of 10 or less.
All right. Yeah, that's pretty remarkable, 25 people. There have been a few questions that have come in about the flu season. Questions like, do you expect this to be a significant flu season? Do you think with the more mask wearing that the flu season will be less impactful this season?
So we're hoping. I mean, so far, I mean, we've seen – you know, I think one or two documented flu cases. But if you look at the Southern Hemisphere that's ahead of us, they actually, their season has been kind of less than half of what it normally is. So, you know, if you think about all the things that, you know, people have been doing since March, you know, logic would say that it would also decrease flu because it's also, you know, can be droplet and contact. It's the same thing. So we're hoping just, you know, by doing, you know, the simple masking, distancing, you know, hand washing, you know, we're hoping that, you know, that our flu season will be much less, you know, than it has been in previous years.
Well, that's encouraging. When should we get our flu shots?
So actually, they became available in September. We've always gone kind of with the mantra of October. That gives you a 6-month protection from October through the end of the March, which is, you know, into March, which is usually our flu season.
Okay, good. Can you just kind of remind the listeners of what some of the symptoms are to look out for COVID-19?
Yeah, so, you know, it's interesting how this has evolved. In March, when we started seeing COVID, you know, we saw a lot of patients present with upper respiratory symptoms, cough, fever, shortness of breath. As we've evolved, we still see some of that, but we also see those patients that have nausea, vomiting, diarrhea. We went through kind of a GI round, and, you know, one of the biggest things that we've seen over the last couple of months is fatigue, muscle cramps, muscle aches. I mean, and just really not feeling good from that standpoint. So what's made this tough to distinguish COVID from other illnesses is the symptoms have broadened significantly. Mm-hmm. It's not just the respiratory that we all thought when we first, you know, started this, that was the mainstay. It's interesting that, you know, other symptoms have come into it since that time.
Yeah. And so that makes it hard. Like we were talking about earlier, you know, if the minute you get a symptom, you immediately start to think, oh my gosh, this is COVID-19. So the question is, when do you call your doctor?
So, you know, we ran into a lot of this, you know, with fall allergies. Somebody would sneeze, somebody would cough, and, you know, they would either get sent home from school or, you know, something else would change from that standpoint. And, you know, at the end of the day, you know, some of it's a duration. You know, and the other thing is whether the symptoms are worsening. So, you know, we have never backed away from the idea that if you don't feel good, you're sick and it's mild, stay home and quarantine. Mm-hmm. Stay away from people. Stay at home. And a lot of times if it's allergies, if it's something else, you know, it'll actually pass in a couple of days. And even if it's mild COVID, it'll actually pass. But, you know, if symptoms progress and people continue to get sicker, that's when you definitely need to be seen. But I will say that's one of the benefits of all of us doing virtual visits is to answer that question. So, you know, if somebody has symptoms, you know, we have pretty strict protocols of who can come into offices and, you know, how they come in. But if you have access to virtual visits, that's one way to be able to actually have a conversation and really get some peace of mind, you know, around symptoms.
Yeah. And if you don't have a fever, is it likely that you don't have COVID?
That's what we thought initially, but we've seen plenty of patients who have presented with symptoms, multiple symptoms without fever, and they've still turned out to be COVID positive.
Okay. That's interesting. So let's talk about the indoor and outdoor thing. You know, the children are back in school. A lot of the restaurants have opened for indoor dining as well. Would you be comfortable eating inside of a restaurant at this point?
You know, yes, because I think restaurants have done a really good job. And I'll extend that out to, you know, other businesses as well. I mean, I think they've done a good job in social distancing and, you know, requiring masks, you know, and most of the time. But restaurants in particular have been pretty, you know, vigilant about limiting capacity, you know, spreading out tables, you know, having people wear a mask until they actually sit down. So, I would be comfortable and, you know, I've done it, not a lot, but I mean, I have done it, you know, and I don't mind saying in Greenville itself, there are quite a few of the restaurants who actually, you know, ran their plans by us. You know, we don't endorse anybody's plans, but they said, hey, you've been taking care of employees for a while. And, you know, we've had little to no transmission in our employees. They said, you know, what do you think? So, you know, we've actually given our opinions, you know, to some of the school districts, to some of the restaurants. We've just looked over their plans and compared it to what we've done, you know, for, you know, the last 6 or 7 months. And so, yes, we're comfortable, you know, especially the ones that can provide outdoor dining. Mm-hmm. You know, that's even better from that standpoint.
But we're going into the winter. So,
right.
Yeah. So if we're outside and we're dining, or we pass people walking, like you said, is there something to this 15-minute time with somebody, or if we just pass them and they don't have a mask on, are we probably okay?
Right. If you look at the science, what it says is a true exposure is 15 minutes inside 6 feet with somebody. Okay. So just passing on the street, pretty unlikely.
Okay. So here we are, almost October. November is Thanksgiving. December is Christmas. Lots of families typically gather, travel. My son and his family are in Nashville. My daughter's in Asheville. Is it safe to go visit them for the holidays?
You know, I think it is if you take precautions, but also you need to make sure that they've been taking precautions. Because, you know, as we age naturally, just by aging, our risk goes up some. And so, you know, where we saw in the second surge, where we had such a big, you know, increase, a doubling of what we had in the first surge, we could track it back to teenagers and college kids, you know, bringing it to their parents and their grandparents. So, I mean, I think at the end of the day, if you make sure that who you're going to visit has been doing the right thing, you know, you wear your mask, or, you know, if you're there and everybody's been doing the right thing. But I still think you really have to be mindful of close contact and, you know, sharing bathrooms. Let's be honest, it's still a risk.
Yeah. Yeah. And the kids are playing sports now.
Right.
You know, and so, like I've said to them, well, if you guys can quarantine for 2 weeks before I come, I would feel better about it. But it's going to be a difficult holiday season, I think.
It's going to be very different. It really is. And, you know, when you come from a big family and you're used to doing that, it makes it even tougher.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, just to be frank, we've been real strict about who would come see my mom. You know, I mean, she's at high risk. So, I mean, you know, yeah, I mean, we'll let people, but, you know, we've got to know that they've been doing the right thing. But we also, you know, we make them keep their distance, you know, wear a mask when they come in the house.
Yeah, well, and when I visit my mother, we always sit outside. They won't let me in their house.
Right.
And if I go in to use the bathroom, I have to clean it. So let's see, a couple of questions that came in. Do you think that virtual visits will remain available for all future diagnoses for any possible transmitted issues like cold, flu, coughing, etc.?
Yes, so they will. Virtual visits, I mean, honestly, we should have really been doing more virtual visits a couple of years ago. There were a lot of information technology issues that kept us from actually doing it. We literally flipped from in-person to virtual visits in 10 days in this market, because we were doing no virtual visits, you know, prior to March. So it can be done, but I'll tell you, it's really become part of our, you know, patient care plan. So going forward, we predict that 15 to 20% of our visits in our medical group will actually still continue to be virtual, more so in primary care than subspecialty, just because in subspecialty care, there's just so many times that an examination is required, or, you know, something else is required. But I think all of us, you know, and talking to my counterpart, even at Prisma, you know, that's part of our long-term plan, is to keep virtual visits as part of our care continuum.
It's a new world. So somebody says here, last night, her 85-year-old parents attended a birthday party for their 26-year-old grandson. 14 people attended. Many of them had been traveling recently. Are you concerned about that?
I would be. I would watch them real close.
Yeah. So let's talk about this vaccine that, or all of these multiple vaccines that seem to be in development. What's the latest that you've heard, first of all?
So the CDC came out with a series of 8 or 9 papers last week around the vaccine, different people across the country. I mean, there's a lot of questions about the vaccine. You know, when will it be available? You know, how much will be available? How are you going to actually allocate the vaccine? You know, so those are just some of the logistical questions that are there if a vaccine, you know, as soon as a vaccine becomes available. A lot of people are worried about the speed to market of the vaccine compared to what it usually takes. And, you know, having spent part of my time in the private world, you know, with a company that was going through, you know, a drug approval, you know, what they actually did, instead of running the FDA processes end to end like they usually do, they layered them on top of each other. So they were able to do a lot of the FDA processes at the same time. And I think, you know, they also had encouragement, honestly, to speed it up because of the pandemic. I mean, you're in a situation that, you know, you need it. The big thing with, and this is any new drug, so you don't really know how effective a drug's going to be until it actually hits the market. Mm-hmm. So even your phase three trials, which most of the vaccines are, you know, in, you know, at this point and are, you know, completed, you know, that's still a limited population. Even though it may be in multiple centers across the, you know, United States, it's still a limited population. It's not until you get something into the general population that you start seeing either how effective it is or the side effects from it. So, you know, for us, it's kind of a, you know, a wait and watch. I'll just tell you, I mean, ever since I've, my whole career, I have been hesitant to put patients on a brand new drug the first 6 months it was out, because we've had so many drugs come to market and then, you know, they find something that they didn't expect or really didn't see in clinical trials and pull them back off the market. So personally, as a physician, and my patients will tell you this, I mean, I usually wait 6 months. And so, you know, I think with a vaccine, I think at the end of the day, you know, hopefully it is going to make a difference, you know, like, you know, science, you know, would tell you that, you know, it should get this under control and everybody goes back to polio, people go back to measles, you know, from that standpoint. And you hope that's exactly what happens. But I think there's just a lot of questions out there that are still unanswered, you know, from that standpoint.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about polio because I'm a member of Rotary. We've been working to eradicate polio for 40, 50 years. And it's still in a couple of countries. But with the polio vaccine, it's like a one-time vaccine, right? Whereas right. like the flu vaccine, you get new vaccine every year. Which do you think COVID is going to be more like?
Well, I mean, I think COVID is probably going to be more like a flu vaccine, because it is in a coronavirus family. There are multiple coronaviruses. You know, the flu vaccine, that's what some people don't understand. It's made new every year. And it's actually an educated guess as to what strains that we're going to see in that particular season. So mm-hmm. the flu, they start making the flu vaccines, and we actually pre-order our flu vaccines in the spring. So as soon as we get to the end of flu season, we're already ordering vaccines for the next flu season. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's going to be interesting to see, you know, what happens with COVID, but I think, you know, it may very well be the same thing. I think that is, you know, hopefully when we get into the early part of next year and they've really had time to go back and look at a lot of the data, not just in the U.S., but from all over the world, because now they're really looking at the different strains of, you know, of the coronaviruses to see, you know, what's out there. I think once they complete that, that will really help answer the question about the vaccine.
Yeah. Lots of questions coming up about traveling. And I hear, I agree with what Steve is saying here, that thank goodness for Hangouts and Zoom so we can see our family, but we miss hugs. So traveling, with if I'm traveling by car, are there certain things I need to think about if it's like a long trip or an overnight? Or if I'm traveling by plane, are there certain things I should be thinking about?
Well, I think, you know, let's start with planes. So, you know, you can only social distance so far in a closed environment like a plane is. I mean, I think with planes, the biggest thing is, you know, hand sanitizers and mask, and just, you know, and, you know, just really keeping distance when you can. You know, that quite a few people, you know, travel by plane, and the feedback they get is that they, you know, they are trying to do the right thing to, you know, protect people. But once again, you know, the hand sanitizer and the mask is really your best protection, you know, when flying. And then by car, car's a little easier just because you can pick and choose where you go. You can pick and choose where you stay. But once again, I would make sure that, you know, if I stayed in a hotel, that, you know, the services that you touch, You know what? It you know, people may think it's crazy, but it takes, you know, it takes just a few minutes to actually clean those surfaces if you take something with you. If you're really going to be truly, you know, do what you can to protect yourself, that's really what you need to do, you know, from that standpoint.
Yeah. So bring your hand sanitizers. I know some planes are, they're not even leaving the middle seat empty. So if you need to get some water or something, you're taking your mask off. So,
right.
Yeah, it's definitely a challenge. So let's see what else. So other questions that we've had, people are really finding this very useful. Here's a question. If you receive a standard or even a high dose flu vaccine, will it help prevent you getting COVID-19, even if there is a no or slow COVID-19 vaccine available?
No, they're actually very different. They're different viruses. And so, you know, it wasn't, but, and, you know, people don't talk about this as much. You and I talked about it a little bit earlier, you know, as we head into flu season, one of the things that we worry about is if somebody does get the flu, you know, that, you know, it challenges their immune system. And so it could make them more susceptible to COVID because, you know, none of us know how good our immune system is until it's challenged. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, that's part of the unknown factor. And, you know, in the second round of this, what we saw was a lot younger patients getting sicker than the first round. And, you know, it was really interesting. Our average age in the first surge was probably 74. And so, you know, we did not see many young people at all. Matter of fact, very few, you know, in the first surge, March and April. But in the second, you know, we started getting patients in their 30s and their 40s who didn't do well. Some of them didn't make it. And so, you know, it's interesting. And, you know, to be able to look back and figure out why, I mean, we can't do that now because we're still in the middle of it. But I think for those of us on the clinical side, it's going to be really important to understand the difference in the aggressiveness of COVID-19 in the first round versus the second round, because it's definitely been a lot more aggressive and people have been significantly sicker in this second round.
So it's mutating potentially.
You know, when they're in the preliminary, when they look at it now, they are saying now that it's a different strain. Hmm. And so that's naturally what you would think. We'll kind of let the scientists do what they do and help us figure it out to see if that's truly, that's our theory. So, you know, we hope that they're going to be able to look through that and kind of give us feedback as to, you know, does that actually pan out?
So do you think masks are going to become just part of our everyday life going forward for into 2021 and beyond?
I think it'll be that way for a little while. I'll tell you, we're planning till the end of March right now. We don't plan on lifting anything we're doing until the end of March. Which is essentially through flu season, you know, and I think is, you know, we look at this on a regular basis. I mean, one of the advantages to being part of a big health system is we have teams that this is what they do now. This is their job. They look at the different aspects of COVID. They look at, you know, they look at masking, they look at visitation, you know, they help us look at everything together. So we can, you know, in the local markets, we can actually focus on taking care of patients while they help decipher CDC information, like DHEC information, which, you know, we have equivalent of DHEC in every state. So they help us do that. So that's the nice part. But it, you know, right now we plan on being this way until the end of March.
Okay. So you talked about some of the protocols and things that you've learned and how things have changed since this all started in March. What are some of the, besides the virtual health, what are some of the things that are different in the hospital now?
So we still don't have open visitation. So we still have, you know, one visitor per patient per day, except at end of life. You know, at end of life, we make exceptions. I think you should always make exceptions at end of life or, you know, somebody who's seriously ill from that standpoint. So that's different. We still have isolated units in our hospitals. So we have areas that, you know, where COVID positive patients go versus patients who are under investigation for COVID. In other words, we're waiting on a test result to come back. So we have separated areas. We've got separate ICUs for COVID patients versus non-COVID patients. So all those things are in place. We still have our surge plans in place. So what that means is if, you know, and you know, we've already gone into our stage two plan around ICU beds. So, I mean, we literally have stage one, two, and three plans that where we would stage three, which we're not in and luckily haven't gone to, is where we use every available bed. We use every available ventilator, you know, from that standpoint. None of that's changed. So we didn't back anything off from that standpoint. We continue to have, you know, procedures in place in our offices around screening for symptoms and how people come in, not congregating people in our waiting rooms. Basically, you come in, you go to your exam room, you get seen, you get done, you go straight back out the door. So we have all those things in place that were put in place in the early part of this and refined, you know, over the summer. So, yeah, they're still in place for us.
And you talked about staffing being a problem when it surged. How do you address that going forward?
Well, I mean, you know, it's interesting because, you know, you basically tap out travel nurses, you tap out locums to help some of your physicians. It's really, I mean, I'll tell you, I mean, our nursing teams and you know, my counterpart is the chief nursing officer here. Her and her teams have just done an incredible job in just literally, you know, in bed management. And so, you know, 3 to 4 times a day, you know, we would get bed updates and then we would provide support wherever we needed to from that standpoint. And I say that because, you know, in May, at the end of May, first June, patients had got comfortable coming back to the hospital. In the first surge, nobody wanted to come to the hospital, which was not good because we saw a 20% increase in our mortality rate of out-of-hospital, you know, deaths, you know, which says people are staying home that shouldn't stay home. And I mean, that was Greenville County's percentage, and it's, you know, it was similar, you know, in other places. But as people got comfortable and realized that, you know, we were keeping the two populations separate, even if we thought somebody might have COVID, they were kept separate from the, you know, from the heart attacks, the strokes and all that. But about the same time we did that, and then, you know, we'd put off well over 1,000 surgeries in the first surge or canceled, you know, surgeries. So we brought those online. Well, you had the perfect storm. So as our surgeries ramped back up, patients started getting much more comfortable. That's when we had the big second surge. But I can tell you, you know, we canceled some surgeries early on in June. I canceled probably 10 surgeries the 2 weeks after July 4th. But we have not had to cancel any surgeries other than that. Now, for us, it's a little different because we test our elective surgery patients. So urgent surgeries, emergent surgeries, or procedures, those went through all along. We've never changed what we do, you know, with people who needed care right then. You know, what we have been able to do in the meantime is get rapid tested. So in the hospital, we have ability to do rapid testing, which is about a 15-minute turnaround. But that's what we'll use for, you know, critical patients or surgical patients that, you know, there's a concern that need to be tested. But you know, our elective surgery patients are tested prior to surgery. And then, you know, basically we ask them to, you know, to quarantine at home for a couple of days before. And so if they're negative, we move forward with their surgery. We've had little to no issues there. We've had, you know, we haven't had many, you know, we've had some that were actually positive. You know, what we do at that point is we cancel their surgery. We put them off for 4 weeks, come back, retest them. If they test negative, then they'll go ahead and reschedule. So, you know, so, it, you know, the same things that we've been doing, we'll continue to do from that standpoint.
Okay. So you've been a great guest, really incredibly helpful. So thank you for all of that. I put the Bon Secours website up on the screen. So if people have ongoing questions or want more information about COVID-19 as of a particular day, your website is constantly updated with that information.
Sure. Right.
So that's where I would point you all to go. I also wanted to a couple of things before we wrap up. Last week, our guest, Kathy McAfee, offered a gift. We had a little contest for people, and we have a winner for that contest. Her name is Laura O'Connell. And Laura is going to win an autographed book from Kathy and two free sessions, one with Kathy and one with me. So congratulations, Laura, and thank you to everybody who entered that contest. My guest next week is John Tarnoff, and he is out in California. He's a career transition coach, speaker, and author who started his career actually in the movie industry. He helps late career professionals transition to meaningful and sustainable second act careers. So following the work that we did last week with Kathy on personal branding, I think this is going to be a great follow-on. So hopefully you will all plan to attend. I always like to end with a quote from C.S. Lewis. He said, you are never too old to set another goal or dream a new dream. So thank you for joining me today, Dr. Blackstone.
You're welcome.
Thank you for everybody in the community. Let's continue to meet weekly to learn, to dream, and to share. I am so grateful for all of you. My name is Wendy Green, and this has been Hey Boomer.